Hello, this is Robert Kiyosaki, and this tape we're doing is part of the Advanced Learning Package of Cashflow 202, which is the advanced fundamentals of being a solid investor, which includes being financially literate, as well as understanding some of the investment techniques and different methods of how money is made in the real world, should we say. And today I'm very excited because I get to talk to a dear friend of mine, all the way from New Zealand, who now lives in America, part-time, but also because we get to talk about my favorite investment vehicle, which is the subject of real estate. Although I do own several million shares of companies and those kinds of investments, my love has always been in property because, in my opinion, property is and always will be the investment vehicle of the very rich. It's probably the most stable, the most, in my opinion, logical. And that's why I personally have a bias or an opinion why I love real estate personally, and the largest part of my portfolio is in real estate. So with that, I'd like to introduce a dear friend of mine, Dr. Dolph DeRoos. And Dolph, would you mind telling the story of how you and I got to meet back in 1994?
Certainly. It's a very interesting tale because what happened is I was doing a seminar in a little town in New Zealand called Timaru, and I was walking down the main street, and I came across a bookshop there, and in the window was a book that, you know, the title of it just appealed to me, so I bought it. And I was reading it on the plane the next day going to my next seminar engagement, and I got off the plane, I just finished the book. The person who was hosting the seminar there picked me up, and I said, "Mick, you've got to read this book. It's by Robert Kiyosaki, and you'll enjoy reading it. Here it is." And he said, "Oh, yeah, Bob." I said, "It's not Bob, it's Robert." He said, "Yeah, Bob, he's my neighbor." I said, "For heaven's sake, this is some Japanese Hawaiian guy living in the States." He said, "I know. I used to live in Hawaii, and we were neighbors."
Yeah, Mick and I played rugby together in Hawaii.
Yeah, so it seems. So I thought this is just very coincidental. And then I went to an event, I guess a couple of months later, where someone suggested I should go to a business school in Hawaii. And I had little inclination to go other than the fact that the same author of this book would be teaching there.
So that was me, huh?
Yeah. I thought this is the chance. So off I went, and that was July 1994. And as you'll recall, things happened at the business school which caused us to get to notice each other, and we've been in touch ever since.
Been dear friends ever since. And also, for those who do not know it, Dr. Dolph DeRoos is very famous in many parts of the world for his many books on investing in the property market, and he has a software package which I think is absolutely genius, because the hardest part of acquiring real estate is the analysis of it. You know, does it make sense, and how can you make more money out of what might not look like a good deal? Is that true?
Exactly. And the funny thing is, you say it's a very difficult thing to analyze. In essence, of course, it's very simple. But you've got to understand that with most other investments, it's much easier to see what the returns are. For instance, if you've got $100,000 cash and you put that in the bank, and every year you get $6,000 interest, everyone can work out and figure out for themselves that the effective interest rate is roughly 6% per annum. That will vary slightly depending on whether you're paid quarterly or semi-annually or monthly, but in essence, you're getting 6%. But if you buy a property for $100,000 and it returns you $6,000 a year in rent, the return is not necessarily 6%. In fact, it's going to be far from that. The yield, to use that technical term, the yield may be 6%, because the yield, by definition, is simply the ratio of rental income divided by purchase price. But that gives you no indication at all as to what your true return is. And we'll get into that a bit later.
And that's what your software package does.
Exactly. It tells you very simply and in 30 seconds flat exactly what the return is from that property. And most people are astounded time and time again how a property that might look very good on paper, in fact, isn't a good investment at all. But more particularly, how a property that looks mediocre, in fact, is an exceptionally good investment. That when people realize the true returns, they say to themselves, "Well, we'd be a fool not to buy it," as indeed they would be.
It's an absolutely brilliant package. And the best part about it, it's almost like a checklist also. It makes sure that all the things you need to assess are included.
Right. People tend to forget about things. They tend to put in the rental per annum, but they forget about the vacancy rate.
Right.
We take account of that. They might put in their mortgage, which starts off at an interest rate of, say, 7% for 3 years, interest only. But then they forget that you're onto a table mortgage, according to that loan document, for 15 years. The program takes account of all those things and gives you the true cash flow return pre-tax, after-tax, and more particularly, it tells you what your true return is. We call it the internal rate of return.
That's a brilliant package. But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves right now.
Mm.
Would you mind tell us a little bit about your background? That's a very interesting story because his name is Dolph DeRoos, more technically, Dr. Dolph DeRoos. Would you mind explaining what a doctor is?
Sure. That is, in fact, a PhD in electrical engineering. But to get to that point, we have to go back a little in time. I had my first business in Australia when I was living there, and I was visited by three government officials. And the first one looked down at me. It was this big, burly guy, and he said, "Do you have a license to operate this business?" And I said, "No, sir, I didn't know I needed a license." And the second person said, "Do you have a health department certificate?" And I said, "Well, no, I didn't know I needed one of those either." And the third one said, "Just what do you know about your business?" And I said, "Well, my sweets taste pretty good."
You're selling
sweets on the beach. I was 8 years old, and they closed me down there and then.
Oh, candy.
Yeah.
Oh, candy. Okay,
yeah,
sweets,
we call them sweets. Candy. So I learned that in order to do business, you had to follow certain rules. And, of course, the next day I opened up business as a fruit vendor because there were no similar rules on fruit. And it was ironic, of course, because candy was wrapped in cellophane, whereas fruit wasn't. So the health risk surely would have been greater with fruit. So I have sort of business instincts in my blood. I always liked the idea of making some money. And when it came to studying, and I came from a family where they sort of put a high value on study, partially because my parents went through the Depression era and the war, and they felt the way to security is to have a job, because when you have a job, you can climb a corporate ladder. And so there was this encouragement to study, and I went through a process of elimination. I didn't know what I wanted to study. I didn't want to do medicine because I didn't like the sight of blood. Didn't want to peer into people's mouths all day, so that cut out dentistry. I wanted to do law, but I realized early on that if you study law in one country, that limits you to operating in that country forever. So I did engineering. And even though I enjoyed engineering, in my first year as an undergraduate, I realized that engineers in general were not very wealthy. They wore shabby clothes, and they drove old cars and lived in mediocre houses. So I took it upon myself, Robert, to make a study of rich people. I read encyclopedias, autobiographies, biographies. I interviewed some, and I tried to figure out what is it that rich people have in common. And, you know, I could hardly find anything. It certainly wasn't age. You could find rich people amongst old and young. It wasn't gender. It wasn't religion. It wasn't which country they were born in. It certainly wasn't whether they were born into a rich family or not. In fact, I only found two things that they had in common.
What was that?
Well, the first one was that almost without exception, rich people had integrity. Their word was their honor. Now, with the benefit of hindsight that I've had since, I don't believe that if you don't have integrity, you cannot become rich. Obviously, you can. But I believe you'll find it harder to hold on to your wealth because you'll associate with people who similarly don't have integrity, and they'll do you out of your money.
Plus, if people don't trust your word, it's really harder and harder to do business that way.
Exactly. So it's an important point. It has no bearing on your ability to make money per se for each particular deal, but it does have a huge bearing on your ability to make money long term in your lifetime. But secondly, and perhaps more interestingly, the other thing that all rich people tended to have in common is property. They either made their money through property or they held their wealth in property. And it was in that moment that I realized that I decided to get into property. In fact, I bought my first investment property in my first year as an undergraduate student. And, you know, as I often tell people, if you think I look young now, you should have seen me then. I had a major problem. I was 17 years old and I looked about 12. That had problems when you tried to date someone too, of course. But it also had problems going to a bank, asking a bank manager for a loan. He would think to himself, I'm sure, subconsciously, if this young upstart is buying property, so should I be, and I'm not doing it, so he must be wrong. It was tough, you know.
Right.
But that gave me a lot of metal, too, to sort through in later years.
So, Matt, real quick, where did you go to school?
I went to school at Canterbury University. I continued with my studies, yes.
Okay.
I did a bachelor degree first and then did a PhD. And I enjoyed it, and I think I, you know, had a flair for it. But the real crunch came when I finished my PhD. You've got to understand, you've been at university for 8 years. You have foregone a salary in order to have a degree which supposedly is going to earn you lots of money. And I was offered a job back in those days of $32,000 a year.
That's New Zealand dollars.
That was New Zealand dollars. And, you know, we've got to take the time value of money into account. That was worth, in today's dollar terms, it's worth a bit more. But it wasn't a very good income. I had done a real estate deal the week prior which had netted me $35,000. And I thought to myself, why work for 49 weeks of the year, 40 hours a week, report to work and say to some boss, what would you like me to do today for $32,000 a year when with one real estate deal you can make as much money and have a lot more fun along the way? So that's the time when I quit being an engineer.
So did you ever use your electrical engineering license as an employee?
Well, not as an employee. It's come in very handy, of course. People need toasters fixed because they figure an electrical engineer obviously fixes toasters. Well, you do get that sort of general feeling. But no, I've never really practiced as an engineer. I have done a lot with technology companies, and I'll have to admit that the engineering background has been good for that. But, Robert, it goes beyond that. Just about any subject you can study at university is what I call an analysis subject. You take what's there, you pull it to pieces, label the components, and put it back together. That works whether you're studying history, chemistry, geography, geology, anything. There are very few exceptions. One of them is engineering, and that is that engineering is not an analysis subject, but a synthesis subject. You are given a problem, and you have to create a solution. You have to synthesize a solution for it. The same goes for architecture, sculpting, a few other professions like that. So engineering is, in fact, an extremely good background to figure out how to creatively solve real-world problems.
The process of solving it.
Yeah, it's the process.
Right.
And real estate investment is a process. You are given a unique spectrum of problems. You mightn't perceive them as a problem. They're challenges, if you like. And you have to creatively come up with a solution. An engineer has a much easier task to solve that than, say, a historian or a mathematician or anyone else.
Because your mind has been trained or disciplined to think that way.
Right.
And that's why you can write the software program how to analyze a real estate transaction better than a person like me could probably.
Well, thank you. I'd put it this way, that probably there are computer scientists who could write the code better, but they don't have the relationship with the real world.
Right, or the real estate world at least.
Right.
So let me ask you this. So you probably never used your electrical engineering degree to its fullest.
Correct.
You went right into property. And we've talked about this because you've also floated a public company, so you have shares also.
Right.
But we were discussing this in the car. He said, why do you think, which I agree with, but why do you think real estate's the best, a far better investment vehicle over stocks and bonds?
Well, I would put it slightly differently. It's not why I think that. It's why I know it to be so. And it goes as follows. There are three fundamental reasons. Firstly, let's imagine that you've got $100,000 cash. Somehow you've managed to accumulate that. If you were to buy shares or stocks with that 100,000 cash, the first question is, how many dollars worth of shares can you buy with your 100,000 cash?
100,000?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a silly question, you almost think it's crazy.
But you have $100,000 in cash, how much in real estate could you buy?
Exactly. And some people say, well, 150,000, 200,000, maybe half a million. Well, I tell you what, you can buy $1 million worth of property with 100,000 cash.
At least.
Easily. Right. You know, people do it every day of the week. Which tells you two fundamental things. You know, you don't need the money to buy property. That in turn shows that, firstly, banks think property is a very safe and secure investment.
Which is a very good point, because you're the one who pointed this out to me, a keen sense of the obvious. If we went to, let's say, Bank XYZ, and Bank XYZ was a publicly traded company, and we went to the bank and I said, I want to invest in your stock on the stock exchange.
Right.
I have $100,000. Would you give me a loan of $900,000 to buy a total of $1 million worth of your stock, Bank XYZ stock? What would the banker say?
Well, they wouldn't even say anything. They'd laugh you out of their office.
Yeah, in other words, they will not loan money on their own stock.
Exactly.
But they will loan you money on a piece of dirt with a house on it.
Right. And, you know, when I make this first point that with $100,000 cash, you can only buy $100,000 worth of shares, some people say, oh, no, banks lend money on shares.
If you already own them.
But you've got to understand this. They'll only go up to a certain percentage, typically 30%, and it will only be on a select few stocks that they have faith in.
Right.
In general, for most share market investors, they have to put up the cash.
Right. They won't give you 30 years at 6% or 7%.
Right. But here's the second point. We've only covered one so far. We've got two to go. So the person who's bought $100,000 worth of shares for his $100,000 cash, the question now becomes, how much are those shares worth?
Well,
it's a silly question again.
Right.
They're worth $100,000 because the market has determined that that is the market price. There is only one market price. It's that price at which willing buyers meet willing sellers. So by definition, your $100,000 cash has bought $100,000 worth of shares. Now, if we ask the same question on your property, your $100,000 worth of cash that has bought $1 million worth of property, how much is that property worth? And it's anyone's guess. That property may be worth $1.2 million. It may be worth $1.5 million. It might only be worth $700,000. If it's only worth $700,000, you've paid too much for it. And if you're wondering how it's possible that you can buy a $1.5 million property for $1 million, Robert, you know the answer to that. It happens all the time.
Every day. I can give
you 101 reasons right now why people sell properties at below their true value. And we can cover some of them. four kids have been bequeathed a property. They disagree as to how to get rid of it. They have this big argument, and they say, look, let's just sell the damn thing and be done with.
Right, because they're not property owners.
They're not property owners.
They don't know how to manage it.
Right, or someone bought the property back in 1956. They paid $13,000 for it. They think they're ripping you off by getting $460,000, when in actual fact it's worth $580,000.
Right, the point that Dolph is making is one of the advantages, and maybe a disadvantage of real estate, is that it's an inefficient market.
That's the advantage, of course.
Yeah, it could be advantages, disadvantage, but we use it to our advantage because it's inefficient. What I mean by inefficient is you can walk down the street, you'll see an apartment house or a commercial building or a strip mall, I mean a retail mall, and the market is what you and the buyer, you as the seller or the buyer, determine it to be.
Right.
But in stocks, it's electronic.
Mm-hmm.
And so millions of people can watch the price of your share go up or down at that moment.
Right, and there's only that one price.
That's correct.
It's like saying there's one price per square foot of property around the nation.
Right.
And, of course, that wouldn't be a problem for us, too, because
we'd
pick the eyes out of the market and pick those that are worth above that. Anyway, we've got 2 points. Let's move on to the third one. Your $100,000 worth of cash that's bought you $100,000 worth of shares that are worth $100,000, the question now becomes, what can you personally do to increase the value of those shares?
So that gives you the control over the value of your property.
Well, when it comes to property, when you ask the same question, your $100,000 cash that's bought $1 million worth of property that's actually worth $1.5 million, what can you personally do to increase the value? You can do a whole raft of things. You might just paint it.
Right.
You might put a new facade on.
Let's get down to, let's say, the mass market right now, because most people can't think in $1 million piece of property. Let's say a $50,000 property.
All right, a $50,000 home.
What can a person do to improve the value of that house versus what can they do to improve $50,000 worth of a share?
Well, my answer to that is something that probably won't be believed by a lot of people. You might just paint the guttering or the spouting on that house. It was flaky and looked rusty, and you paint it white, and you put that house back on the market, and suddenly it's gone from $50,000 to $55,000. And you might think that's nonsensical, but I'm telling you, there are people out there who otherwise would have bought that property, but they see the rusty spouting and they think, man, this whole place is probably a dump. It's not worth anywhere near that amount.
They see what's wrong with it versus what's right with it.
Right. You paint it. You might just mow the lawns. You might paint the building on the outside. But we can do a lot of other exciting things. Let's talk about a $50,000 home somewhere in the back blocks of nowhere. And it hasn't got a garage or a garage, as you call it, or a carport. It's bought at $50,000, what would it bring up in rent? Maybe $100 a week, so that's, 10% return. That's not bad. The question becomes, if you were to provide a carport, by how much could the rent go up? And my answer to that is, let's assume the carport costs $1,000 to build. I think that's pretty reasonable in any market. If your rent goes up by $20 a week, because now the car is out of the wind and the rain and the sunlight and all that sort of thing, $20 a week on an annualized basis is, of course, $1,000 a year. So you can get $1,000 a year coming out of that property extra because you spent $1,000 in capital. Now, that's a good return in anyone's reckoning.
So it's 100% return.
Per annum.
Right.
But we might even do something a bit smarter than that. We might go to a bank and say, look, we're going to build this carport. It's going to increase the rent by $20 a week or $1,000 a year. Could you tell us how much the value of the property will go up by if we have $1,000 a year extra come out in rent? And they might capitalize it, and that's a technical term to say the extra capital value brought about by cash flow income. They might capitalize the increased value at, say, 10%, which would mean the building has gone from $50,000 to $60,000. And if they'll advance you 70% of that increase in capital value, you'll get a loan from the bank of $7,000 because you're going to build a carport.
Improve the value of the house.
Now, of that $7,000, we use $1,000 to build it. So we haven't put up any cash at all. We've borrowed $7,000 from the bank. We've used $1,000 to build the carport. We are pocketing $6,000. And by the way, at this point, I'd ask, is that $6,000 taxable?
No.
And the answer, of course, is no. It's not income. It's a loan. So you've pocketed $6,000. You've got a carport there. It's generating $1,000 a year in rent. We have to pay interest, of course, on the $7,000 loan, which even at a ridiculously high 10% is only $700 a year. You're collecting $1,000, so you've got $300 a year coming in for life, assuming the rents never go up, and $6,000 in your pocket. My question to you or anyone else who owns a property, a $50,000 property, would be this. Why would you not build the carport?
I don't know.
And the carport, Robert, is just one simple, silly example. If we make it a $250,000 property, you might be able to add an extra bedroom and do a similar thing. Or if you've got that $1.5 million building, you might put in a whole car parking building. And that's not such a ridiculous thing. I was looking at a building in Fort Worth. It's a 56-story building. It's one of the most impressive buildings there. It had a rental per square foot that was relatively low because there were insufficient car parks. And all we did is contracted to buy a car park building next door. We could assign the car parks to the building. Suddenly, the rental per square foot went up by 65%.
No kidding.
You know, these are just the possibilities where if you open your mind, you say, wow, this is a game where we can set the rules. And that comes back to what you were saying. You have control over areas that were shares or stocks and bonds. You just have zero control.
Right. Most people, when it comes to, let's say, stocks or shares, as we call them, you have no control.
Right.
The price goes up, the price goes down. You're totally out of control. And we were talking about that earlier. An investor, most people, when they buy a stock, are speculating.
Right.
Or
exactly.
Risking or gambling. And as a real estate investor, you don't take risks, do you? Or you do your best to minimize your risk.
You minimize the risk. It's a calculated risk.
Right.
But you can be so certain about the outcome, you know, in all probability this is what's going to happen, that I don't even perceive it as a risk.
And that's how personally I look at it. When I buy a building, one fundamental rule, and the word is rule I have, is if it doesn't put money in my pocket now, I don't buy it.
Right.
And with a share, I can't do that. With a stock, I can't do that a lot of the times because I put money into it and I'm just hoping for what we call capital gains. The price will go up and hopefully it won't come down. And that's about all we have. And we're taxed upon those gains.
Right.
And that's another part about real estate is that, at least in America, let's say my stock goes up like $1,000 profit. I'm taxed on that in America.
Right.
And in America, if my real estate goes up by $1,000, I can shelter that. I mean, I can defer the taxes on it.
Right.
And not
invest
only
it
that,
in something else or roll it over, whatever.
And not only that, we're going into advanced tax strategies and all this. One of the most wonderful things that I love about real estate is a lot of times I'll pay too much money for it. And the reason I'll pay too much money for it is because my business is throwing off so much money. I want the depreciation. So I want to depreciate the building.
Right.
I want to depreciate the building to take what I call good losses.
Mm.
You see, with stocks, there's only one kind of loss, a bad loss.
Right.
And in real estate, there's good losses as well as bad losses. And the good thing about real estate is I can control my good losses.
That's a very interesting point that you raise. And in essence, we're talking about depreciation, or what's called a capital allowance in some parts of the world.
It's
and
definitely
it like
a very capital allowance.
Right. You buy a
the government giving you money.
They are giving you money.
Yeah.
And it works out effectively that they write out a check and give it to you because you bought a property.
Right.
Now, you think about it. When you buy a computer or a vehicle, most governments allow you to depreciate those items because that's their incentive to have you update your computers to stay competitive with the rest of the world. So you buy a computer for $5,000, you write it down to $2,000, and you deduct that against your income, that $3,000 paper loss. But the computer has gone down in value. So will the car have
that's
gone down
That's a real
in
loss.
Right. So the assumption is that you can depreciate items that go down in value. Now, surely to God, governments realize that properties go up in value, and yet they still allow you to depreciate them. And it's not a loophole. They're fully aware of it. The reason is they know that they are not very efficient at providing housing for those in need.
That's correct.
They want you to provide that housing.
And we were talking about it. It was one of the complaints that you and I have personally have had. There's people out there who are adversarial to the government tax system.
Right.
They teach you to how to cheat the government, how to, what are some other schemes they've come up with?
How to continually have to look over your shoulder.
Right.
To make sure you're not being caught up.
Yeah. Mm. What most people really forget to see is the tax code, the revenue code, is written to show you how you can be tax or government friendly as far as taxes go.
Mm-hmm.
So Dolph and I are birds of a feather because we would rather be on the government side than be adversarial to the government. So when we talk about tax or tax advantage things, that the government actually puts those so-called loopholes out there because they want you to do certain things. It's their
right.
way of saying, I'm giving you an incentive to do this. And when it comes to real estate, the biggest problem the government has is providing houses for the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the reasons they encourage people from the I quadrant or the investor quadrant to invest in real estate is very simply because people are going to provide housing or buildings for businesses to operate in or retail outlets for other businesses to operate in. We help them do the government's job, which is provide more capital for the market. So I just want to say this up front is I would rather be on the government side when it comes to taxes rather than being tax adversarial.
Right, I fully agree. And the delightful aspect of this is that, and the software shows this beautifully, you can have a property where on paper you are running at a loss,
But in actual fact, you're running at a profit. And the effect of that is the government agrees that you are running at a loss. In other words, you can reduce your income tax.
Substantially.
Substantially. While at the same time, you're actually pulling money out.
Because the government wants to provide housing for the masses.
Right. And the reason that works with property and nothing else is that you get depreciation, both on the building and on what we call the chattels. They're the contents, the carpets and the light fittings and all those things. You add up those depreciation items, you can deduct them against your rental income. On paper, you are running at a loss. Whereas in actual fact, because those deductions aren't cash deductions, they're just paper entries, you're still running at a profit. Despite getting the profit, the government effectively writes a check to you. They give it to you and say, thanks for buying that property. And you know what? The yield that we spoke of before, the rental income divided by the purchase price, that does not take account of the money you get from the government.
That's right. A lot of times when I said to somebody, I'm making $25 a month off this building, oh, that's not much money.
Mm-hmm.
But all they see is the cash-on-cash return and not the real return over the basis of the investment.
Right.
And that's why I've always recommended that people, like my game Cash Flow, and is learn to read the numbers.
Right.
Because in the numbers is where you find the money.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, since they're not financially literate or not been trained to look at financial statements, they fail to see where the acres of diamonds or the millions of dollars are made. All they see is the cash in pocket or cash in hand versus the real game going on.
Exactly, exactly.
So what other advice do you have for people who are thinking about getting into real estate? What words of wisdom can you give them, or inspiration or motivation?
Well, firstly, I'd say don't waste your time learning the tricks of the trade. This game is so simple in relative terms that you may as well learn the trade. There's not much to learn. You have to know what the word collateral means. You have to understand the meaning of equity. A few other terms like that, once you've got those under your belt, you're set to go. And I relate it like this. It took me 8 years to get a PhD in electrical engineering. It probably only takes 8 weeks to learn, I'd say, half of all you need to know in property. The other half comes with a bit of experience. In relative terms, it's simple. It astounds me that more people don't do it. I am continually astounded, Robert, at the number of valuers or appraisers out there, the number of real estate agents, the number of people working in the periphery of real estate without actually investing.
We could stop this real quickly and interrupt you.
Mm-hmm.
Is the value of making sure you have good advisors or people in the business, because most people who are in the real estate industry are not real estate investors.
Exactly.
And that's what Dolph is saying. And they sit there, they look at millions of dollars being made right in front of them, and they take no action. And the worst part about some of these so-called brokers and advisors or escrow agents or title officers and all this,
mm-hmm.
they really don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They know a small part of it. So a very big part of what we're saying here, we're talking about in the car coming up here, is when most people look at real estate, they look at it as emotional.
Right.
It's the house of my dreams.
Yeah.
I want to buy this thing.
Right.
You know, I want to, and you get emotional about the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're saying is we don't get emotional, it's just a number.
It's just a number. It's just a transaction. And that really brings me to my five golden rules, if you like, of property. And you hit on the first one there, which is never, ever fall in love with a property. Fall in love with the deal, by all means.
That's great advice.
But never the property. Because as soon as you fall in love with it, your emotions, as you say, take over. You'll buy it because you really like the shape of the garden or the color of the wallpaper in the third bedroom. And they are the wrong reasons. You've got to be able to look at it in the cold light of day and say, this is a good investment. Or not. And follow your head.
The numbers.
Either
yeah.
way, yeah. Follow the numbers.
And we were laughing about that because my wife Kim and I were... We buy more investment properties, and we're very unemotional with our properties. It's just how much? What's my rate of return?
That's mm-hmm.
like, how much money is it going to take? What's the numbers?
Mm-hmm.
And we started looking at our house, and I forgot that we were looking at a house that we were going to live in, and not a piece of property
right.
that we're going to rent out. And my wife and I started to get into it as husbands and wives do,
mm-hmm.
and I realized she was looking at the house emotionally,
mm-hmm.
and I was looking at the price I could get the house at,
right.
and I was still looking at the deal,
mm-hmm.
and she was looking at living in the house,
mm-hmm.
which goes back to the original point, is I would highly recommend that if you're looking for property, find a real estate agent and a title agent, a banker, a mortgage lender, who all understand the game of real estate investing,
versus buying the house of your dreams.
Exactly.
Very different people.
And to that extent, look for people who are investors themselves.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
A lot of people have a phobia about that. They think, no, if he's an investor, if she's an investor, then any good deal that comes along, they'll gobble it up themselves. Nothing could be further from the truth. There's a limit to what any of us can buy at any one time based on short cash reserves and you know, other financial matters. So they will know what you want. They will speak your language. They'll understand your motivation, and they won't waste your time with deals that you can look at and within 5 seconds say, this is hopeless.
Right, and they won't ask the same questions a lot of times. I'll go up to a real estate agent or a salesperson. I say, what's the motivation for selling? They go, oh, it's got 3 bedrooms and 2 bedrooms. I said, no, I want to know how desperate is this guy to sell.
Exactly.
And I go, well, why do you know that?
Yeah.
Because I want a deal here. But don't you want to look at the bedrooms? I go, no, I just want to know one thing. How badly did they want to sell?
Mm-hmm. The worst case I had was an agent who offered me a property. It was a commercial property, but the yield was 5%. And I said, well, tell me, why is this a good proposition? And he looked at me for a moment and he said, well, if it wasn't, they'd be asking more, wouldn't they?
You're kidding me.
I'm serious. It's a sort of convoluted logic. And that's the level they're at. That's why he wasn't buying and I was.
Yeah. So I'll make this point again. Just because a person's in the real estate industry does not make them a real estate investor.
Right.
And when you find a mortgage broker, a banker, a title company, and a real estate agent who understand the world of real estate investing, your job will be 1,000 times easier.
Exactly. And you touched on the next point, which is only buy from a motivated seller. You know, the worst thing you can do is go to someone and say, do you want to sell this property? And they say, well, everything's available at a price. What's your price? You're going to have a hard job to get that at a good bargain value. So only buy from a motivated seller.
And what most, and this is, Tim, my wife and I was laughing about this, which comes up to a lot of people are afraid to make offers.
Right.
For instance, we were looking at this one house, and the price was $1 million for us to go live in. And we looked at it, and I said, oh, we'll offer $700,000 for it. And the broker almost died.
Mm-hmm.
He says, how can you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You'd embarrass me. And you can't do that. You can't fire an offer so low. And I went, and that's when I called you and said, you know, Dolph, guess what? They came back at $800,000.
Yeah, I know.
They came down from $1,350,000. And I fired this ridiculous offer of $700,000. It almost embarrassed me to write it. The broker was just, you know, sweat coming out. You're going to insult this guy.
He was more concerned, I imagine,
with
his image.
Right.
And
well, I was feeling a little guilty. I said, this is a little low. And when the guy countered at $820,000, I went,
was it too low?
He came down almost $500,000 or $400,000. And then I turned to my wife, Kim. I said, there's a lot of people who are so afraid of keeping their image up.
Right.
They won't even fire an offer. An offer costs nothing. It's free.
Hey, and know your thought. Yes, you may get.
Yeah.
So there's no downside.
If they say no, obviously they're not motivated.
Mm.
Please turn to side B of this tape.
In fact, I once had it where I went to an agent and I said I want to put an offer on a building. It was a $600,000 building. My offer was for $280,000. And it was what we call a mortgagee in possession sale. So it's like a foreclosure sale where the bank had closed down on the current mortgagor. So he said, I can't present this offer. It is too ridiculous. It is outside the bounds of reality. So I said, that's fine. And I went to see his boss. I said, now listen here, either you or I has a problem. And quite frankly, I don't think it's me. He said, well, what happened? I said, well, I went to your agent so-and-so and I tried to put in an offer, but he refused to present it. He said, well, our agents have to present
all offers.
That's part of the deal with the vendor.
For those of you listening, every real estate agent must present the offer that you write.
Right.
They must present it. Even if they hate the offer by their professional code,
mm-hmm.
they must present the offer. And a lot of them are so embarrassed that they say they don't want to do it.
Right. So he said, what was the offer? And I said, $280,000. And he winced and he said, I can see why he was embarrassed by that. He said, but no matter, I'll present it. And then I did something with that offer that everyone should listen to very carefully, because this is a technique you can use to make your offer very, very seductive to the vendor. And that is, I stapled the deposit check to the offer document. So I stapled this check to the contract, the head of this company took it to the bank. The bank was the mortgagee in possession. And an hour later, the bank phoned me, and their words were, and I'll never forget it, they simply said, "We have deposited your check." In other words, they accepted the offer.
Wow.
And as I was saying to you before, Robert, if you have too many of your offers being accepted, the simple fact of the matter is that you're offering too much. You've got to get sharper on your offers. You've got to offer less and be rejected time and time again.
Which is why, again, the numbers are important. Your software package is important because you going back to one of my rules is I don't buy anything unless I make money immediately from it.
Right.
And if so, so many people are afraid because their self-esteem or they want to look good or not embarrass everybody around them,
mm-hmm.
and they offer too much, well, that cost of low self-esteem is costing you fortunes.
Right.
And you have to submit offer after offer after offer and be willing to have people sometimes go wince, as you say.
Well, let's talk about numbers just for a moment. I'm still working my way through my 5 points.
Can I add one thing?
Sure.
Is the point that I do when I submit an offer is my mortgage broker is one of my most precious friends.
Mm-hmm.
And what the mortgage broker does is attaches a letter rather than me sending a check. It says, Robert Kiyosaki is substantial,
mm-hmm.
that he has the money on hand,
mm-hmm.
and he will close it in 10 days
mm-hmm.
if you want. And what that does is it lets the seller realize that myself as the buyer is serious, substantial, and I have the money. And if you come across as strong, even though your offer may be low, they'll think a little bit longer about the offer. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Of course, because most purchasers, when they put an offer, say that it is subject to finance. I don't know if that's the terminology.
Yeah, exactly the same term we use.
Okay. So they think, all right, this offer, if we accept it, we still don't have a guaranteed sale. It might take them 3 weeks to figure out that they can't raise enough money to do it.
And they pull the house off the market for
right.
that long.
And not having it sold for that 3 week period may cost them more than the difference in price between that person's offer and your offer, which is guaranteed.
Right.
So I fully agree.
Yeah. So you want to come across as strong, especially if you're going to offer low.
Well, you have to come across as strong if you're going to offer low. So how do you know what to offer? Well, I look at it this way. You have got to look at 100 properties to be able to put offers in on 10.
Right, that's exactly my number.
Yeah, and you just keep looking. And
you might, of those 10 you put offers in, you might
have 3 accepted.
Right.
I say if you get more than 3 accepted, as I said,
offer
you're offering
too much.
So you only get 3 accepted. That doesn't mean to say you've bought 3. You still have to finance them or do due diligence on them, make sure that everything's in order. You might only end up buying 1 property out of that original 100. You may end up buying none. And if that's the case, you have to look at another 100 properties. And Robert, if I had to say this is the one point where most potential investors or existing investors fall down, it's that they lose the impetus to look at their 100 properties. Right. They'll look at 17 this weekend and 18 next weekend. But then Cousin Joe's getting married and it rained the weekend after that, and they had some other event to go to, football game. So then they say, they were wrong at that seminar anyway.
Right. They don't invest the time.
Right. They don't persevere.
And there's millions of deals sitting out there.
Oh, there are so many. One of my favorite sayings is that the steal of the decade comes along about once a week.
And I use that saying all the time. I know it's yours, but I take it now.
And this is my take on it. If you believe that to be true, you will find that steal of the decade every week. But if you believe that the steal of the decade only comes along every 10 years, once
you've
found one, or you've heard that I've found one, or you've found one, you will stop looking for 9.9 years. You'll say, well, that was it for this decade.
Well, what I've actually heard people say is, you know, I missed a deal 5 years ago. I said, so? And they're still hurting about it.
Yeah.
I'll never, you know, it's almost like, well, I missed it. There'll never be another one.
Exactly.
You know, I hate to say it, but my dad, my educator dad, the school teacher, said, you know, I missed out on the... And it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't doubt it was one of the biggest... I mean, I got sick when he told me he turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
But to this day, he still tells the same story about the deal he missed rather than going looking for another one.
Right. Well, that brings me to another point, and you can bounce back and forth on this for a long time, I guess. But when markets are good, people tend to think that they'll always be good, and they jump in boots and all and buy things at ridiculously high prices. And conversely, when there's a cyclical downturn, and things aren't going well at all in the property market, as it happens every 7 or 10 years in various regions, people think, oh, things are bad, I'm never going to get into this market.
Because emotionally they check out of it.
They check out. And that's when you've got to have the guts to say, no, this market's going to come back. I'm going to buy right now.
Or one of the rules I have is what I buy needs to make sense in a bad market as well as a good market.
Right.
One of the controls that real estate allows you
right.
is we control the deal.
Right.
We control the returns.
So when we've gone through a bad phase and I'm encouraging people to buy but they don't because they're scared, and then the market improves again, I'll have so many of them write in your ring and say, I knew it, I knew I should have bought, but for some reason I didn't.
Right.
They phone you to complain, in essence, about their own lack of activity. Right. And that's the thing where you've got to have a bit of courage.
And I've also heard other people say the other side of it, is I'm not going to buy now because the market's too hot.
Right.
You know, so they check out when there's good also.
There's never a bad time to buy.
No, that's because that $1.35 million house, this is the hottest real estate market in the history of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I went and offered $700,000 for the house, and the guy came down to $820,000.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the best market in the history of my state, this is 1999, January 1999, as they're doing this,
mm-hmm.
I still find a deal.
Yeah.
And I could have got it at half price. And, everybody, and the broker was saying, well, you can't do that because they want a full price offer. So everybody wants a full price offer. I'm not willing to offer it.
Mm.
Is that exactly what you're saying?
Yeah, perfectly.
So
yeah.
Even in an up market, you can still find a deal.
That's right.
Because it's an inefficient market, which is good on your side.
Right. You can have arbitrage, not so much of markets, but arbitrage of thoughts and values.
Right. So
people's perceptions of values.
The guy was transferred. The house had not sold in 3 months. Nobody had offers on it. All the real estate brokers had gone through the house.
Right.
And they weren't showing the house anymore because they said the thing was not going to sell. It was ugly and blah, blah, blah. And, so the real estate brokers had turned off the entire market to this house. And it was sitting there vacant. And this guy is carrying this house at, I think, $800,000. All he was asking for me to do was to pay his bank note off.
Exactly. And, you know, often I said before there are 101 reasons why people have to sell a property at less than its true value. The one you just mentioned is the most common one, where people are shifting. Often they have committed to another property. They have to close on that within a limited time frame, and their time limit to get rid of their old house is running out.
And plus, they're paying for it.
They're paying for it. Now, he was asking 1.35. Maybe if he'd asked only 1.2, he would have got it, because all those agents that went through would have had people that could afford 1.2.
Because people are afraid to make an offer.
Right. But because he asked too much, he was squeezed. He was painted into a corner so that he had to accept 800 or 850, whatever, in order just to get rid of it.
Right.
That brings me to my third point. These are my five golden rules, if you like. And it has to do with when you put in an offer. Sometimes it's worthwhile putting in an offer where you name the figure. But in general, Robert, my rule is never be the first to name a figure. Let someone else name the figure first. There's no upside for you in being the first to name the figure.
So let's say they're asking $100,000 for a property.
Well, then they've named their figure.
Oh, okay.
All right. Then you know where they're coming from. But if you see a property and you think it might come on the market, never go out to them and say, well, I'll give you $125,000 for that, because you don't know what they would have come in at. So if you can avoid it, never be the first to name that figure.
Okay.
And then one rule which you and I practice to the nth degree is always buy with zero or very little down. Put as little cash into it as you can. And one of the things...
Or take out as much as you can.
Well,
we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, that's not uncommon either. I've done deals where I've bought a property...
Tax-free money.
And I've gotten a mortgage for it where the mortgage is more than the purchase price.
Yes.
Now, I know many banks are saying that they will consider for mortgage purposes the lesser of the purchase price or the registered appraisal. But there are ways and means that you can have to get around it. You can get deferred settlement for 6 months. And then by the time settlement comes around, you go back to the bank. The purchase price is no longer relevant because it was bought 6 months ago. It's now worth X dollars. You've painted that spouting, remember?
Right.
And you can get more. You can pull money out. The other thing while we're talking about it is the property market is so delightful because there are no rules. You know, when you buy shares, you have to pay cash for those shares. You imagine going to a share broker and saying, look, I've got an old BMW that's only firing on three cylinders. Will you take that as part payment for my $100,000 worth of shares? You know, they'll laugh. But with property, you can do anything. You can trade. You can say, well, I'll give you this property over here and a car and something else as part payment. And people do it.
It's called, I don't know what you call it, horse trading or whatever. It's so much fun.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying it's typical or that you have to do it. But the point is, you can do it. It shifts people's paradigms. And you can do great deals that way.
I did that with, you know, one of the rules I have, we got it from Keith Cunningham.
Uh-huh.
You always buy more than you want. What most people do is they try and buy what they can afford.
Right.
And really, the one of the biggest keys to getting rich is buy more than you can afford.
Mm-hmm.
Buy so much, you have to sell the rest of it off.
That's right.
And so many times I've horse traded because I go to a person who says, land, if I need 20 acres, I'll buy 80 acres.
Right.
And then I'll trade and swap and try to get my land for free. But unfortunately, most people only look at what they can afford rather than buying what they can trade off. If you buy more, you have to trade it anyway.
That's interesting because often the most inefficient vendors or sellers are government institutions or big insurance companies or institutional consortiums. And the reason is they don't understand property. It's not their core business. So they'll, for instance, try to sell off a portfolio of 16 buildings and offer it at a very good yield just to get rid of it.
Something like 10 cents on a dollar or 50 cents on a dollar.
Something like that. And you've got to ask yourself, why would they do that? Well, they're scared. They're scared of being left with that last building that won't sell and they have to dump on the market. So all you have to do is contract to buy them as one lot and then split them up.
It's called you buy the box of them or you buy a portfolio.
Right. There may be very few people in the market for a $50 million portfolio, but there are lots of small, you know, family-run organizations that can afford $5 million investment.
Well, they
would sell off 10 $5 million investments.
Right, and this is another part while we're talking about this. Most people don't have the time to look for those.
Right.
And so for those of you saying, well, I don't have the money to buy a $1 million portfolio, well, do you have the time? Because it's either time, either invest time or money.
Right.
And if you have the time to look for those deals and you're good at putting them together, people will give you the money.
Exactly.
And that's one of the biggest secrets of all where we're talking about, don't use your own money.
Right.
That's one of the best things about real estate is the bank will give you money for it.
And, you know, I always
Friends will give you money for it.
Yeah.
Why do you need your own money?
Right. Right. Now, that's a very valid point. And that brings us to the final point, which is you make your money when you buy.
Exactly.
You know, you can buy something for 50 cents on the dollar, half its true value, instantly. Let's say you're buying a property worth $100,000 and you manage to get it for $50,000. And again, if people think that's not possible, how could that be? It happens every day of the week. We could go out here in Phoenix today and find a deal like that.
And have a great time doing it.
And have fun doing it. And perhaps we should. Probably the only reason why we don't do it is we think, well, that's only $50,000. Now, it's not as if we couldn't both do with $50,000 today, but we're thinking in terms of projects further down the track.
Well,
otherwise, we should do it.
When we were in our 20s, that was a big deal. Now they get bigger. That's what happens. You get bigger. It's the same process.
Right.
But what we're trying to say to you is start with the $20,000 to $50,000 deal.
Mm-hmm.
And there's millions of them.
Yeah.
No matter where you go in the world, there's millions of these little $20,000 to $50,000 deals. Even the most expensive cities in the world, there's always been a $20,000 to $50,000 deal. Even in New York, I found them. They're, of course, they're pretty bad, but it's where you start.
Right.
And then what happens is your capital, but more than your capital, it's your intellectual worth goes up.
Mm-hmm.
The process is the same.
Right.
The numbers increase.
Mm-hmm.
But the process is the same.
And word gets out. As soon as you start having a few successes with these deals, real estate agents will start phoning you and saying, hey, we've got another oddball deal here. Would you be interested in looking at it?
Especially if you have the finance to take it down for it.
Right.
Quickly.
And
all they want is the commission.
They want the commission.
They want the tip, as my friend says. He says most real estate brokers work for tips. They work for 6% in America, 7%. He says even a waiter works for 20%.
Right. And the only reason we floated this public company is that I got so many people phoning or writing and saying, look, we want to participate in some of these deals you're doing. Can you organize them? Would you syndicate something?
So people with money.
Yeah, people with money. So I did a mail out to my database.
And what you know is how to find and negotiate a deal.
Exactly. Yeah. That's all it is.
And that's priceless.
And I asked how many are interested, thinking if we get a dozen, we might be able to do some pretty clever deals. Well, we had 700 people reply saying they were keen to do something.
Wow.
And that's when I realized that a syndicate wouldn't cut it. And we decided to float a company.
Go public, right.
And it just goes to show these people are learning by what we're doing in the public company, and they're getting the tools to do it themselves.
A lot of people just don't have time.
Right.
They're so busy, they want you, they'll give you the money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just take the time to learn how to acquire the deals.
Right. And this brings me to another point that's dear to my heart. I mean, I'm a bit of I have an aversion to television. I mean, there are some good programs, but there are so many people who would spend hour after hour watching programs that they think they ought to watch because they want to keep up with the play and what's happened in this soap or on that series. And the thing that I don't like about TV is it doesn't encourage your brain to become proactive and think things through and devise strategies, and you become a bit of a potato. Whereas even reading a book is far more creative because you have to paint the pictures in your own mind, and you have to physically turn the pages and all that sort of thing. What sets property apart, again, from almost any other investment vehicle is you have to think, you have to strategize. I wonder if this suburb is going to go up or down in value. I wonder what's happening in this part of the world or the city. I wonder whether this kind of building is going to be in demand because, hey, people are starting to do things on the internet. We don't need as much warehousing space. So it goes on. You become very active, and you can get addicted to that mindset where you're constantly thinking things. It's exciting.
Curiosity.
It's like the difference between reading a really good book or reading one that's just waffly and doesn't have any substance to it.
That's great. You have a saying about if you can read but you don't read?
Yeah. He who does not read has no advantage over he who cannot read.
That's a very great statement.
You know, and another way of putting that is if you don't read, you may as well be illiterate.
Right.
You know, so my advice is to get out there and read. It shocks me to know that 58% of people in the Western world do not read a non-fiction book after leaving high school.
58%?
58%.
It is
astounding.
And when you and I get together, that's all we talk about is the books we read.
Yeah, the books we've read. And, you know,
the
ones you mentioned today,
read,
a lot of them we have read. There's some that you mentioned that I haven't read, and I've already noted them in my mind, and I'm going to go out and get them and read them.
Fabulous books.
Because to me, that's what life's
expands
all about.
Expands the mind, yeah.
Expanding, exploring, learning more.
Right.
And as soon as you stop learning, that's when, in my mind, you might as well give up.
So, Dolph, a question I'm asked and you're asked constantly, and when I may as well ask it of you, is, if a person, let's say, just has a job, very little in savings, how do they get started in property or real estate? What would you recommend?
Firstly, I'd recommend that they live a reasonably frugal lifestyle so that they can build up their savings. It takes very little to get started in property, but you do need something. If that really is out of the question, like you cannot accumulate any savings or you don't have the patience to wait that long, there are other options. You might put the deal together. You might find a stunning proposition and then go and see some relatives and say, look, I know you've got some capital or access to some, or would you want to use your home as collateral for a loan so that we raise $20,000, which we then use as a deposit on this property, and we'll raise the other $80,000 required to buy it from a bank, and you cut them in on the deal.
And use their financials.
Right. So it comes back to using other people's money. It's like being high on drugs. It's OPM. There's a whole raft of measures like that you can use. You might just go to friends and put a proposition to them.
As excellent, excellent ideas, and I'd like to put it from another point of view, is one of the reasons I recommend people look at either starting their own business or network marketing per se, is because real estate is capital intensive.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I were discussing in my new book coming out about what my rich dad taught me about investing is coming out, is that it really does behoove people to have a steady stream of cash flow via which to buy property with. And in my opinion, a lot of times people are trying to use property to get rich rather than have the vehicle which makes them rich, which is a business or some source of steady income or frugality or proper cash flow management. Because if a person is poor at cash flow management, that is often the reason they don't have money in the first place.
Exactly.
And if you're poor at cash flow management, then you'll mismanage your property anyway, and your problems will accelerate. I mean, leverage, you know, one thing that's great about leverage is OPM or using other people's money. The problem with leverage, it goes up as well as comes down.
Right.
It's a double-edged sword. So really, if a person doesn't have much capital to invest with, I would first look at yourself and say, how can I become a better cash flow manager? Because if you're not a good cash flow manager, first of all, the bank's not going to give you the loan anyway, and you'll mismanage your property, secondly, and your problems will not be of a $10,000 nature. It'll be a $100,000 problem.
Right.
So it really comes down to personal skills again, too.
Right. And expanding on that, if you don't have any cash flow initially, then banks are going to be very reluctant to advance your money. Once you've got 20 or 30 properties, they don't even look at your ancillary cash flow or cash flow from other jobs. They just look at the portfolio. But when you're buying your first or second or third building, they look at your cash flow. It's very crucial.
Right. Another thing that happens with banks, if you have too much property, they get suspicious also.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Why are you talking about that? You know, banks get uncomfortable once you reach, say, the 4 property level.
Right.
And they say, but you're getting top-heavy in property. So at that stage, you have to go to a new bank.
That's
and they
right.
see you as a 4-property person, and buying one more property is no big deal.
Right.
But by the time you've got 8, they get uncomfortable. So you go to yet another one.
Right.
And the beauty of it is that after 4 or 5 years, you can go back to the first bank because either they've changed manager and forgotten about you, or your circumstances have changed so that it doesn't matter.
Right. And so the bank is, first of all, going to look at how well you manage your money. And if you're not good at that now, please don't invest in property. That's
right.
That's really what I'm trying to say, because if you're bad at that, property will make the problem your problem worse.
Exactly.
And the other thing about banks is that it comes a time when you have too much property. At that point, it becomes your business.
Mm-hmm.
And what Dolph is saying is, today I don't have a job. I don't have the normal sense of support that most people have, but I can always go to a bank because I have a portfolio, and I have to have my numbers in place, my numbers accurate. I have to use the same language a banker would use. So these are all things that I invested time in learning first. Many people are trying to invest money, but they haven't invested the time. As I said, investing is both time and money. And if you don't invest the time, then it takes a lot of money. And if you don't want to invest the time, it also costs you a lot of money.
Mm.
So please invest the time in what people are doing right now, which is their education. So it is a double-edged sword as far as which comes first, the money or the property, but I think they almost come simultaneously. But a big part of it is being willing to, as we say, be literate, to study, to be open-minded and to learn.
And to have an attitude which is that you want to increase your net worth, so you're not going to waste your money or take on projects which are going to be a drain on your cash flow.
That's correct. Mm. And when people go to relatives, that can be a big boom or it could be a very big bust, you know, especially if the deal goes bad on you.
Sure.
So really...
I'm not suggesting that's the best avenue open to you, but I am saying that if you are desperate to get into property because you can manage your cash flow, you do see the potential, and you don't have any cash reserves of your own, it might be a good option.
Right.
It's better than not doing anything.
Right. And that's why I recommended right off the start when we started talking about this tape was your software package and buying your books by Dolph Roos. There's also books by Robert Allen, Nothing Down and Creating Wealth, which are good fundamental primers.
Right.
So that's how I got started. In fact, the way I got started was I bought off a TV infomercial a Nothing Down seminar, which I attended for $385.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell that story. That $385 has made me millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
Yet another person who spent the same, my friend of mine who attended the same course, so that course was a waste of money because he made nothing off it. And we spent the same amount of money. It's just I used what I learned and he didn't.
Right.
And so those are some of the big variables in there.
Right. Well, people always say that knowledge is power. And, you know, nothing could be further from the truth because knowledge of itself is worthless. Even if you know the mating habits of moths in Ethiopia, of what use to you is that?
Right.
It's only applied knowledge that's power. If you can apply it, then it's powerful. And that's what you're saying. You applied the knowledge you picked up at this Robert Allen seminar. Your friend didn't.
Right.
That's the difference.
Another part, if I could say to people who are wondering how they get the money, I'm not recommending it. It could be misconstrued, and I don't mean to do this. But in the movie Wall Street with Michael Douglas and who's the other guy? Charlie Sheen.
Right.
Michael Douglas stands up there and he says, a statement that everybody still talks about, it's called greed is good. And a lot of people, the socially response, that's terrible. How dare you say that? Yet, I will say this much. I don't think greed is neither good nor bad. It's just greed. You know, we all have it. We all possess it. And every time I've gone out and I found a deal that was so good, greed has always motivated me to find the money. And I have found that when it's really good, when I see, you know, let's say it's $1 million building I can get for $300,000, divine inspiration comes in immediately.
Of course.
So a lot of it is not worrying about where do you have the money, but get the education and start looking for the deals. And when you start finding them, you'll start, your whole ability to attract money will come up. But it still takes being a good money manager.
You have to be a good money manager. And the thing is, a lot of people stumble across deals, but they don't recognize them because they don't have the tools to be able to...
They can't analyze it, as I say.
Once you have the tools in place, the deals, you'll see them every day
every
of the week.
Every day.
And then you can act on them.
Yeah, and sometimes I don't have money. I don't understand that mentality.
Yeah.
I really don't. Because they're sitting out there, I can't make enough money. I have to stick to my job. I don't understand that. It's...
You know, and Robert, another question that always comes up is, if you're so good at this property gig, why are you teaching about it? And it's kind of a fair question. You know, why don't I just go out and do another deal? But the answer goes beyond that. One of my biggest thrills, and I'm sure you can relate to this, is the letters you get from people who say, hey, I attended a seminar of yours 3 years ago, 5 years ago, and at that time I didn't really believe it, but I thought, well, I'll give it a go. I was working in a hamburger bar or doing some menial job. I didn't own any property. I never thought I'd own an investment property. Well, now I own 3 investment properties. I'm about to buy my 4th, and I just wanted to say thank you.
That's what we do it for.
Knowing that you've changed someone's life, their financial life, forever, even though you'll probably never see them again, it does something to you that dollars can't buy.
Right.
It's sort of giving back to something that's been good to you.
Well, and that's why you and I hang out together, because we're actually teachers more than anything else.
Right.
There's some people who are not teachers. They're just pure investors.
Right.
But we're teachers. We love teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we teach together so often. Another tip about that issue of how do you get the money is start with a small deal. You know, why do you think you have to be J. Paul Getty or Donald Trump? I have found that my income or my intelligence increases the moment I put money on the table. And what that means is a lot of people look at deals, but they don't put any money on the table.
Right.
And the moment that money goes hard, as they say in our industry, in other words, you're committed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the story of, you know, bacon and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chicken is involved, but the pig committed.
Right.
And most people are kind of involved with real estate, but they're not committed.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment you say, I attach a check to this, that I will buy this, your intelligence quantumly jumps. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I've got an example of how that came about. We floated this company, and within 2 weeks of floating, we had shareholders write in and say, well, what's happened so far? How much money have we made? As if they expect things to happen. Now, prior to that, they probably had very little interest at all in what was happening
right.
in the market, what deals were going down.
Right.
But suddenly they had money in there, even though it might have been a relatively small amount, and they were on the ball. They wanted to know about it.
The blood pressure goes up instantaneously, and their intelligence goes up. Their interest goes up.
And your business acumen.
Goes up, yeah.
Right.
So if I can give you a tip, find a small deal, make an offer, and go hard on the money.
Mm-hmm.
Put the money down. And you can always put an escape clause in there saying, subject to approval by my partner, who might be, you know, somebody who doesn't exist.
Right.
But the moment you put the money on the table, your intelligence jumps. And what most people lack intelligence is because what they learned in school is don't make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made thousands of mistakes. I have submitted thousands of offers. I've been laughed at by some of the offers. I've had them reject. I've had more. You say if they're accepting them, you're paying too much.
Right.
I've been rejected so much. And what most people are afraid of is making a mistake and being rejected. But that's what it requires to do a good deal.
Right. And they take the rejection personally.
Yeah.
Now, the rejection has nothing to do with the way you look or how you dress.
They don't even see you.
No.
Yeah. And many times I don't even see the property. I just write an offer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I have property I've never seen. But the deal looks so good on paper, I bought it. I couldn't resist it.
My most astounding purchase was a little property in Queenstown, which is the Aspen, if you like, of New Zealand. It's sort of a winter resort. And it was advertised in a color brochure at the bottom of the page amongst $300,000 and $400,000 properties. And the advertisement literally read, "Help Jed Shift. Offers over 20,000 considered." And it was a little two-bedroom cottage 100 yards from the center of town. And I thought, there's a typo error here or a problem.
So it'd be like buying a $20,000 apartment in Aspen.
Kind of.
Yeah, right.
And I phoned the agent. I said, "What's wrong here?" She said, "Nothing. The owner has absconded to England, owing everyone money. The bank, his own accountant, his own lawyer. They just want to get rid of it." I said, "Well, tell me, you've asked for offers over $20,000. When you ask for offers over X thousand dollars, why should I offer X plus 5,000 or X plus 10,000? She said, "I can't answer that." I said, "All right, here's my offer, $20,000. She accepted the offer. I wrote out a check, by the way, for $20,000, attached it to the offer document, back to what we were saying before, and I sent it in. She presented it to the bank, because the bank at this stage was the foreclosure bank, and they wrote back and said, "You've got to realize that it's worth a lot more than $20,000. Why don't you come back with a sensible offer?" And I wrote back to them and said, "Well,
you asked for 20.
Yeah, if you think it's worth a lot more, find a buyer who agrees with you and sell it to them. I believe a property is not worth what a bank thinks it's worth necessarily, or an appraiser or a real estate agent. They might suggest a high price to get a listing or a low price to get a sale. A property is worth that price at which a willing buyer meets a willing seller. However, to show that I'm still in the spirit of negotiations, I'll raise my offer to $22,000. And for 3 weeks, Robert, I never heard from them. I thought they just abandoned it. And they came back and said, "If you raise your offer to $22,500, it's yours." I bought it sight unseen. And I'm sure if I'd counted at $22,250, they would have said, "No, they wanted to save face." They probably wanted to say amongst themselves, "Well, DeRuth tried to buy it for a song, but we got him up to our price," sort of thing. You know, I went down there to look at it, and unbeknown to me, it was fully furnished. Beds, linen, pillows, kitchen table, chairs, microwave, crockery, cutlery. Unbelievable.
I've done the same. I've bought a building sight unseen and sold the contents for more than it was worth.
You know, and these things happen, and
all the
people
time.
Realize that. And then, just to complete on the story, I was walking down the street a couple of weeks later and met a lady friend I knew. She said, "What have you been up to?" I said, "You won't believe it. I've just bought this property down in Queenstown." And she said, "Damn, I saw that ad. I thought it was a typo. I thought it must have been offers over 200,000 considered." And because she didn't bother to make the phone call,
right.
she missed out. Because the agent involved told me that no one else called.
Right. Anyway, so that goes back to the question of what do you do if you don't have money. The thing is to get started.
Get started. Look at a lot of deals.
Look at a lot of deals, because it's either time or money. And what most people say is, "I don't have any money," so they don't invest any time.
Mm.
I say this, it really takes more time than money.
The money will flow naturally.
Right. If you invest the time, and if you don't allot the time, you'll never find the money or the deal anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer that question, which is a very good question, I'll say it to everybody, if you're not willing to invest the time, it's going to take a heck of a lot of money, or you'll never do it.
Right.
So it doesn't take much, but please invest the time first.
Mm.
So Dr. Dolph DeRuth, I love being with you. You're always inspirational to me, and I really thank you for taking the time and donating your wisdom to those out there who are listening to this tape right now, and there will be people from all over the world. If you could close by saying one thing to encourage people, to motivate them, anything you can, last few words you can say to push them over the line and have them get started, what would you say to them?
Well, Robert, thank you for the opportunity. Your feelings are very mutual. I enjoy spending time with you. What I would say is this: courage does not mean having no fear. courage means acting despite your fear. And when you do that, suddenly your fear will dissipate.
Well said.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And in closing, Cashflow Technologies will be handling Dr. DeRusso's books as well as his software package, or you can also contact him directly. But he has several books. How many books do you have out right now?
Three published at this stage.
Good. And you'll be continuing to write.
Yes, we've got two more coming out this year.
Very good. So thank you very much, and you may want to contact our office if you want to get further information about his books or his software package. So thank you all for listening and for taking interest in your own wealth education. Thanks very much.
Thank you.